if a photographer is composing, they're not just composing an image. They're composing the world or a proposition about the world somehow at the same time. If it's more or less observational work, that's true. And yes, it's not. It's something I think about all the time. I think it's difficult.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today we are going into theory. Today we are going into art criticism and aesthetics and all the really cool ideas and implications and problems that are involved with photography and with visual arts. And there is nobody on the planet, I believe, that is better suited and more articulate and more curious than today's guest, David Kemp. David is all over the place at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, at the Tate Whitechapel Gallery in London, ICP in New York. David is a curator, a writer, a broadcaster, editor, an educator. He has over 20, it says on your website, over 20 books. By my count, there's 24. There are articles and essays. There's curatorial work all over the planet. He's won the ICP Infinity Award, the Alice Award, the Royal Photographic Society Award. In other words, if there's anybody right now who is more involved with the ideas of photography, it's David. David, welcome to the program today. How are you?
Hello, Scott. No pressure. That sounds amazing.
you do have a career, man. I mean, you are probably the most present thinker about photography that we have these days.
Scott, I don't have a career. I just have a life of interests and curiosities. Career is entirely accidental to that. I can quite imagine the career that I've had not having happened at all, and me just sitting around reading books and going to see exhibitions and looking at lots of photographs. I'm very grateful that many, many things have happened and they continue to happen. But to be honest, there's been no career strategy or anything. If anyone is listening, you know, hoping for career advice, I'm not sure I can give any beyond staying interested and feeding your own curiosities, really.
Well, man, you have been interested in film and video and photographic arts from the very beginning. That, you know, that was your college degree. You got an MA in photographic studies, which is now the University of Westminster. What drew you to images when you were very young?
Oh, that would have been very, very good films on British TV. Okay. I'm of a generation that experienced, first of all, only three channels, and then a fourth one came along in the early 80s. But they all showed really superb movies. I mean, there's a whole generation of us that by the time we left high school, we'd seen, you know, most of Godard and Fellini and Bergman and Ozu and Varda and Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. And you don't realize that you've kind of gone in kind of near the top there. So there's a whole generation in Britain that were really shaped by fantastic movies, whether they went into movie making or not. I sidestepped from a love of cinema. This is around the age of 10, 11, 12. I sidestepped into sort of buying books about movies. So this is before home video or anything like that. So the only way to get hold of anything to do with cinema was to get hold of books. And in those books, I really liked the film stills, sometimes more than the movies. And of course, film stills are a kind of curious orphan. They don't really belong to cinema, and they don't really belong to photography, but they somehow belong to both. And I think that got me interested in, you know, the relation between the still image and the moving image and storytelling and the suspension of story and motion and stillness and silence and sound and, you know, all of those differences that you can rack up between cinema and photography, albeit underneath it all, they're very much connected. And then I got a dark room, set up a dark room at home, and really enjoyed all of that, you know, the chemistry and learning what it was to make a print and to try and edit your own work. And then, yeah, then I went to study, and it was a very unusual program where it was half history, theory, criticism, half image making, 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
And very ambitious too. So, you know, by the end of 3 years, I was kind of tooled up on everything, from, you know, semiotics and psychoanalysis to the history of photography and cinema and post-colonialism and, oh, you name it, you name it. It was a real hot house. And London was a hot house at that time, pushing itself,
yeah,
you know, intellectually and creatively.
You and I may have a similar history then. When I was finishing my undergraduate degree and getting into graduate school, this would be 1979, 1980, around there. Right at the, and I grew up as a writer. And so all of my theoretical training was in literature and writing. But we were at the tail end of what was then called New Criticism. And the argument then was, you know, the only thing that matters is what's in the text. Anything outside the text is unknowable. It's irrelevant. You can't deal with that. The pendulum swung a little bit, and the answer to new criticism then was called reader response, which argued the only thing that there is no such thing as a text, only your perception of it. The only thing that matters is what's in the reader's head. And then, you know, a different trend came after that. And at the same time, the writers, you know, in the world were all playing this thing called metafiction. You know, what is a text? What's inside? What's outside? That kind of stuff. This was the theoretical world that the writers, you know, who were trying to write short stories or poems or essays were dealing with. Tell me about your early theoretical sort of schools. I mean, what were the ideas that were being planted early on for you?
Oh, well, they chime with those for sure. So there was a great deal of investigation into kind of structuralism and then post-structuralism and theories of authorship and theories of reader response. They, mm-hmm. Sure, they all rubbed off on me. I'm still, to this day, I come down on the side of the viewer rather than the author, always. I always think of a photographic image as an occasion for response, an occasion for interpretation. I know we can't do away with authors, but I'm more interested in not the facts of the author's life so much as the kind of, you know, vision or impression of an author or an artist that the viewer gets when looking at the work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, I've never met Virginia Woolf, but I constantly read Virginia Woolf.
Right.
And it's impossible not to construct a Virginia Woolf in your head from the work.
Right.
I know that there was a Virginia Woolf that preceded the work, but I don't have any access to that one. So I understand that we can't do away with authorship, and authors make work, but they don't make meaning. They don't, in the end, they don't make meaning. So I think a lot of those debates that you outline there, it's not that I felt indoctrinated by them. It's just that they either felt true or they released something in me, you know? And I mean, even in my work as a writer about photography, I'm very, very careful not to overstep the mark with my interpretations. I'm very responsive to what viewers make of exhibitions that I have curated.
Mm-hmm.
I always find it quite mysterious what audiences make of things. It's kind of unknowable in the end, which is really fascinating.
But as a curator, you are essentially an expert audience.
Yeah, well, one is always one's first audience. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. I mean, I always take the George Orwell advice, which is to write for the smart 18-year-old version of yourself. You know, that's so smart enough to grapple with ideas,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, always on the cusp of something, right? I don't write for my peers. I don't write for specialist audiences. I read an awful lot of specialist writing
right.
around culture and philosophy, all kinds of things. But I don't necessarily write in that way. I just let all of those ideas sink in, and if they mean anything, they'll find their way into my writing. I don't need to force them.
You have a couple moments in your undergraduate career, as I've been, you know, reading your stuff here, that really seem like, you know, wonderful stories. And the first is a conversation with Susan Sontag in which you challenged her, might be too strong of a word, but asked her about her book. Tell me that story.
Well, yes, I was working at the Institute of Contemporary Arts, which is a kind of pioneering institution, still is in a way. It had a bookshop, it had a cinema, it had a talks department, a theater, galleries. It was an incredible place. And part of my time I spent working in the bookshop and also in the talks department. Yeah, and one day Susan Sontag was due to come in. She was doing a talk and a book signing. And she got the time wrong and she arrived early. I mean, I recognized her instantly. And I'll be honest, at that age, I had a crush on her that was probably slightly more than intellectual. And, you know, she came in and I just, oh my God, it's Susan Sontag. And I wouldn't say I'd read everything. I was certainly an avid reader. Particularly of those essays from the 60s and 70s. I was never particularly impressed by the writings on photography. I think they are of their time. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, Miss Sontag, you know, you're 4 hours early. There's, you know, Buckingham Palace down the road or in the circus, you know, pointed her in the direction of the nearest tourist attraction. She said, no, I'm tired. And she pulled up a kickstool and sat down and spent the afternoon with her. And she, after about an hour, I mean, she was a very, very curious person, you know. And after about an hour of me, you know, singing her praises on everything but the writings on photography, she said, David, you don't like the writings on photography, do you? And I said, well, you know... that book is not illustrated, and I was trying to put it mildly. And she said, well, you know, that was a practical decision, and we wanted to keep the cost down and all the rest of it. And I said, no, I think that is the kind of writing you can do in the absence of pictures, and I don't think you're really writing about any particular photographs, not to any extent. And I remember her just thinking, oh, dear, have I said too much? And her shoulders dropped. I remember she had a kind of slightly Chinese shawl on. I remember her shoulders dropping. And then she said, you're right. I find it difficult to write about images. And then she took a breath and I thought, oh God, where's the conversation going to go now? And she said, well, you know, one day maybe you'll write a book that's not called On Photography. Maybe it's called On Photographs, or maybe you'll write a book about a photograph. Both of which, you know, scroll forward a few decades, I've done. And that conversation did stay with me. And it made me think a lot about, you know, writings about the visual arts that do address themselves to very specific works and writings that don't. I mean, they both have their merits. They both have their value. But
yep. And you have a lot of... wonderful ideas we're going to get to in a minute about the interplay between text and images when they're paired together right with each other. But let's hold on to that for just a second. Another thing that happened when you were an undergraduate is the encounter with dust breeding. So, I mean, tell me that story.
Oh, well, yes, that was interesting. So 1989 it was declared the 150th anniversary of photography. I suppose we must be coming up to another one quite soon. And there were a number of big shows all over the world to mark this, you know, great sweeping survey shows. And there was one at the Royal Academy in London, which had never shown photography before. So there's a great fanfare that Royal Academy was presenting a show called, I think it was just called The Art of Photography. And I went along and there were extraordinary things, you know, that I'd only seen in books before. And I remember there was a room called Modern Visions, and it had really striking images, you know, by Laszlo Moholy-Nagy and August Sander and Alexander Rodchenko. And then in the corner, there was this abject little image of Dust by Man Ray. And I just remember being horrified by it. Just that, what is this doing here? You know, among all of these glorious, you know, kind of graphically resolved, extraordinary things, there's this, you know, pathetic little image. And I was kind of angry with it somehow. Like, what is this? But it stuck with me. You know, most photographs leave very little impression on us at all, positive or negative. And I am psychoanalytic enough to presume that if I've had a bad reaction to something, it means something. And it stuck in my mind, that bad encounter with the Man Ray picture of Dust, which is gathering on the surface of the glass of Marcel Duchamp's unfinished sculpture, The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelor's
Choice, yeah.
1920. And thereafter, I just kept coming across it in different contexts, or different writers would refer to it, or different artists would invoke it somehow as an influence or a point of reference. And all of that kind of catalogue of information just, I think, just accumulated in my head. And then Tate Publishing in London asked a number of writers to write essays on single images. And I'd had another encounter around that time with the dust breeding image. And I thought, okay, well, maybe this is a chance to think this through. And it was a, I don't know, maybe a 3,000 or 4,000 word essay. And I got to the end of it and I thought, ooh, I've resolved nothing here. This is really, there's a lot more going on with this picture. And then a very interesting institution in Paris called Labal, which was set up in 2010. I'd worked with them a few times, co-curated their inaugural show. The woman who runs it, Diane Dufour, said, would you like to do your dream show? And I immediately thought, I kind of like to do something that starts with that crazy dust picture and moves outwards from it. I mean, it's a very strange photograph. It looks like it could be micro or macro. When it was first published, it was titled View from an Aeroplane, which was a complete lie. It lived on the pages of various avant-garde journals. When it was in Man Ray publications, it was regarded as a sort of visionary artwork at the onset of surrealism and modernism. When it was in Duchamp books, it was regarded more as a sort of anecdote in the making of his sculptural piece. Eventually, an edition of 10 prints was made in the 60s. And they both signed it. Wow. So, you know, photograph with two authors somehow. Anyway, all of this was really fascinating. And I thought, oh, I'll make just a kind of experimental show that puts lots of images in the orbit of dust breeding and just see what happens. And we made a lovely book to coincide with it, which originally I wanted to have no writing at all. But my publisher, Michael Mack, said, David, we know you're a writer. We know you must have written something. So I kind of handed over my thoughts. And he said, yeah, you could tidy that up and that could be a...
Well, you know, that leads me to sort of a tangent here, because in part of my world as a reviewer of photo books, and I see text, explanatory text sometimes really buried at the back of the book. You know, a couple paragraphs tucked in, maybe even under the dust flap. And other people, there are these huge, ponderous introductions, you know, that tend to explain everything before you see image one. You have spent a good bit of time writing about the interplay between the image without explanation and the image with.
Yes.
Articulate that one for me a little bit. Do you think an image is served well by well-written text?
It depends what the goal is. In journalism, yes, because photographs don't explain what they show. They just don't. They're incapable of explanation, right? So you can show things and they are immediately fragmentary and cut off from explanation. That's great. That's amazing in the pictorial arts. It's not great in journalism. It's not great in the sciences. Photographs aren't, they have the potential to be evidence, but they need to be contextualized, right? And so But the interesting thing is the pairing of word and image was there right at the beginning, right at the beginnings of photography. You know, it went straight to the page. And all kinds of writing began to accompany photographs as photographs spread through culture. And we hardly ever experience a photograph without text somehow. Although a photograph is never reducible to text, I don't think a text can ever explain a photograph. I think there are all kinds of things that images do that are just beyond what words can do.
Right.
I think the pairing of them together produces, you know, a kind of third thing. There's the writing, there's the image, there's what happens when they come together. I am cautious about the fact that we, particularly in the visual arts, where we should be enjoying the visual, right, somehow, even if it's difficult, audiences have been encouraged to defer to explanatory text, what I would call the script for looking. And right. I'm very resistant to that. I know it's done as a kind of wager for accessibility. Don't give the audience something too difficult. You might need to explain it for them. But I think in the long run, it doesn't help because it doesn't value what is actually happening when a viewer encounters images. And I'm always trying to write in a way that might encourage people to value their own visual experience, not to look to my texts for the script for looking or the official account or anything like that. It's probably a mark of my writing that I try to avoid doing that. And that's just because I value my own visual response to things, and I value the visual response of, you know, whoever's looking at the images.
Would you argue, in a you know, fantasy world here of you know, pure intent and pure you know, result, would you argue that the script for looking is limiting in terms of directing or enhancing my experience? You say here on your website, you know, that words do many things for photographs, but in general, they're used to oversee and direct them the way parents supervise wayward children. Yes. Was it not just, you know, children, but wayward children out there? If I take, you know, a standard sort of cliche picture of Westminster, but I put a caption on it, you know, the fate of the Emperor Penguin, yes. I have told you what I perhaps, I mean, it'd be a dumb title for a picture, but nonetheless, I've asked you to look in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. Is that going, I mean, you said earlier the meaning's not in the artist, the meaning's in the viewer. Have I just done a kind of harm?
If it's a title or a caption, that's an interesting question. I would say they are a constitutive part of the work, right?
Okay.
That's not writing from the outside, done on behalf of what's being presented. Titles and captions are interesting things. You know, photographs don't naturally have them. They have to be concocted. They have to be given. Some of them supply entirely new information or ideas that are not suggested by the image.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's what you had in mind with the Emperor.
Or view from an airplane. How about that?
View from an airplane. Yeah, this is actually what Roland Barthes in the 60s called relay, you know, a piece of text that's appended to an image that gives you an entirely new set of ideas to think about in relation to looking. Now, I would see the photograph and the text as the work.
Okay.
That's not the same as, you know, commentary on the work or explanation that comes from the outside. So, for example, if I'm making an exhibition, a photographer might well have titles or captions for their work, and they'll be presented in accordance with the way that the photographer wants. But there might be a text written on the wall at the entrance to the show, which has a curious status. It's not part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
But what's it doing? Is it the institution speaking? Is it the curator speaking? What's the role of that writing? There's a really wonderful book that finally got translated from the French in the 90s by a guy called Gerard Genet called Paratexts. And he's not writing about the visual arts at all. He's actually writing about the culture of the novel. And he says, well, you know, there's the novel itself. That's the text, right? But in order for the culture of the novel to function, there are all kinds of other paratexts. They might be reviews or press releases or blurbs or endorsements or pictures of the writer or gossip or book jacket design. All of these things are not the novel itself, and yet they seem to have to exist in order for the novel to exist and have a more or less present place in the culture. I'm fascinated with the idea of the paratext. And reading that book, reading Jeanette's book, was such an eye-opener to me. He's very methodical. He just goes through all the different paratexts around the culture of the novel. And I think about the visual arts in the same way, exactly the same way.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
But you also argue that photography, perhaps more than other art forms, is it travels. It goes between cultures. It goes between, you know, geographic locations, you know, really, really easily. And the minute you take a picture from one continent and you dump it in another, all of those assumptions have gone away. So I mean, there are no paratexts anymore.
No, but they will be appended. There is no dumping. What would you mean by dumping? Do you mean?
I'll give you an example. Just and it was actually a TV commercial. I was in Northern Australia several years ago, and I turned on the TV. There was a commercial for Coca-Cola, and this family, you know, at a ranch station, they walked out on their porch holding their child. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful looks on their faces, and their entire station is on fire. I mean, huge flames. And they're looking at it as if this is the most beautiful thing in the world. And I asked somebody, I said, this makes no sense whatsoever. And they looked at me like I was an idiot. And they said, Scott, sugarcane. They're burning the cane fields. That's actually an image of harvest, of you know, security. That fire is actually a comforting image in that context. I had no cultural access to that image at all.
Yeah, there are no universal images. This is the great myth, particularly of photography. So often the defenders of photography will tell you, you know, it transcends language borders. It's the international language of communication now. Once you get past the very obvious, like pictures of McDonald's hamburgers or or BMWs or Tom Cruise, suddenly... Mm-hmm. Suddenly things get very, very complicated very, very quickly. But what you're describing is not a dumping. It's not a, that's...
Yeah, you know, you're right.
That's something else.
Well, I got dumped in Australia. How about that? Again, on your website, you know, you talk about the benefit of reading politics, philosophy, anthropology, history, and psychoanalysis, but you don't mention aesthetics. Is there such a thing as an inherently beautiful picture?
Not inherently, no.
Okay. I tend to...
That may be an absence. It's true. It tends to be something that I leave to the viewer. I've never been impressed by writings that just either wax lyrical about what is beautiful or what isn't. Yeah, there are certain photographs that strike me as extraordinarily beautiful. They change, actually. There aren't many that have been very, very consistent.
And I'm not thinking beauty as in, you know, soft lights and you know, fairies flying around, but beauty in terms of, I mean, composition 101, you learn about the rule of thirds, you know, this kind of stuff. You know, when people teach composition in photography classes, there's a foundation behind what they're saying about what is successful / beautiful, although I don't mean pleasant in the beautiful.
Sure. But I think the longer you spend with a kind of pictorial form or medium, the more your attitudes to those kinds of questions change. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything golden and fixed about these things. And it's true that photography introduced any number of new pictorial possibilities. And some of those, I guess, we accept or enjoy because of our understanding of the medium somehow. There's always something a little bit accidental going on. There's always something a little bit spontaneous going on, even in the most controlled of images.
Oh, absolutely.
Photography has access to that. And it leads to the idea that if a photographer is composing, they're not just composing an image, they're composing the world or a proposition about the world somehow at the same time. If it's more or less observational work, that's true. And it's something I think about all the time. I think it's a difficult area to... I've never been completely satisfied with writings on this topic that I've come across. Mm-hmm. It can get a little too dry, a little too quickly. So I think questions of the aesthetics of photography kind of, they come up incidentally in my writings rather than as something I take on as a subject.
Mm-hmm. You just made me think of a marvelous connection. A writer named Barry Lopez, in a piece called The Rediscovery of North America, talked about how the Europeans did not propose anything when they got here. They imposed, you know, what they believed. And when you just said a second ago that a photographer proposes a view of the world, that strikes me as an eloquent way in all forms, whether it's still life or sports photography. But to say, I have a proposition, what do you think? Because a proposition implies a response. Does it? I mean, I'm going to propose something to you, and by definition, I'm waiting for you to say something back.
Yes.
That's a marvelous way to think about it. I want you to talk for a minute about a book, one of your books 10 years ago, but it speaks to my heart, and that's Gasoline. Because not only do I love road trips, but that book and what you did, I mean, first of all, where it started, what it is in the first half and what it is in the second half is really magical to me. And did you know, by the way, that book was 50 years after 26 Gas Stations, that book?
Oh, yes. And there are accents within the design of
my book.
Which are a direct reference to Ed Ruscha's.
Well, I remember the first time I saw 26 Gas Stations, I was thinking, because I was very young, I was like, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't get it at first, but you stick with it, man. But tell me about Gasoline. Tell me about the project. Tell me about the design of the book and the first and second halves.
Well, it's interesting. I was on eBay looking for something, and it's an interesting platform because you can rather speculatively bump into things.
Yeah.
I think, I can't remember what I was looking for, but then I sort of clicked on, you know, there's an option to like see sellers, other items. And this seller had this amazing photograph. It turns out to be a 1979 press photograph. So taken by a photographer working for a newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, it turns out. During one of the gas shortages, so there's a kind of global oil crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's of a woman with her kind of head. She's got her hands shot from outside of a car, side on, and she's got her hands on the top of the steering wheel and her head on her hands. And so she looks kind of exhausted or distraught. You can't see her face. The photograph has been retouched, so black and white image retouched in shades of gray to emphasize all the details so they will look good in the crude halftone of newsprint
papers. Yeah.
And I just saw this photograph and I thought it was
I did think it was the most beautiful image I'd seen in a long, long time. And it was $15. It looked like a, you know, like a James Rosenquist pop art thing or something amazing. I just thought it was incredible. But I was only looking at a bad JPEG and then it arrived. And I thought that really is an extraordinary picture. And I was writing something for publisher Mac, who I mentioned before, actually, they did the Dust book. And I just happened to attach that picture to it, to an email I was sending the publisher. I was writing a text for another book. I think it was a book of Paul Graham's photographs. And I just attached this photograph just because I wanted to know what my publisher thought. And he said, wow, that's interesting. What is it? So I said what I've just said to you. And he said, do you have any others? And I said, yes. I didn't, but I said... I said, yes. So I kind of made a rabbit hole dive looking at images from essentially the 1970s, but not only, around gas stations in America, press photographs. Because if a gas station gets in the press, it's because of the oil crises, or it's because of some kind of crime or something ecological.
Mm-hmm.
In Ed Ruscha's world of just going back to his book, The 26 Gasoline Stations from 62, nothing happens. It's a kind of,
yep.
It's a kind of suspended, you know, post-war world of the automobile, right? Just these
right.
incredibly banal but fascinating shots of gas stations. But it struck me that gas stations are actually very interesting, and they are a kind of lightning rod for kind of global geopolitics, right? Because they're dependent on oil.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up buying lots of these old photos, and I thought, can I tell a story about, you know, oil dependence, gas dependence, just out of these pictures? So I sequenced about 35, 37 of them. And the backs of these old press photographs are just as interesting. So they might have caption details. They might have the photographer's name, the stamp of the agency or the newspaper. They are an archive in themselves. And I suggested a book to my publisher which reproduced the fronts of the photographs in the given sequence that I'd concocted. And then the second half of the book is the back of the same photograph. So you can read just the information on the backs of the pictures. And it was a lovely thing. I made the initial design, which did have a few nods to the Ed Ruscha book. So it's black, red, and white. And the images sit at the top of each page and they come down however far they come down. There's a little text in it, but not much. It's essentially a visual book. It was a great pleasure to do. I'd always wanted to do a book of found photographs. I have a kind of informal wish list in my head of kinds of books I'd like to do, and I'm slowly ticking them off as I go through my ad hoc career. So I don't think I don't really want to do anything twice, so I won't do another book of found images. But I had been impressed of books of found images in the past and thought I'd really like, if the occasion arose, I'd like to try. And that one fell into my lap. And then, interestingly, after it was published, I got an email from a woman in America, said, "Dear David Campany, that woman on the cover of your book, the photograph I've described, is my mother. She was waiting in line for gas for us. She was a single mom. She thought she was going to be late to pick us up from school." Incredible that book had got to the daughter of this woman. I said, this is amazing. And this tells you that, you know, photographs, they don't have meanings. They have biographies in a way. And, you know, my picking up of this old press photograph, putting it in a book, it being seen by this woman, is all part of the story. In the meantime, a very trendy London-based T-shirt company said, we'd like to do a T-shirt with you. Have you got a design for a T-shirt? And I said, well, I'll use this. I love this gasoline picture of this woman at the wheel of a car on the front of the T-shirt, and then the back of the
photo would be on the back of the T-shirt. How about that? And so this very trendy T-shirt was made. And then I said to the woman who'd emailed me, I said, what size is your mother, if it's not an impertinent question? I'd like to send her a T-shirt. So she has her mother has a T-shirt of herself as a much, much younger woman, you know, from 1979. Oh. It's just a beautiful, beautiful story. I got other emails. I got an email from someone who was the son of someone who designed one of the gas stations. And that gas station no longer exists. And there was mm-hmm. a gas in their archive. And could I send them a high-res file of the image? This is lovely. I kind of live for these accidental stories. They're great. They're great. And it does show you how, you know, the life of a photograph can be very, very unpredictable.
Oh, yeah. Now, I got to ask, David, are these T-shirts still available? Can I go find them on Amazon?
They are completely sold out. I get asked at least once a week. that was my one foray into very, very cool fashion culture.
You've hit the big time finally when you made it to a T-shirt.
Right.
Forget the Museum of Modern Art. Forget the tape. But now, I love this notion. Well, two things. There's this notion of images having biographies, because a biography is a narrative. It is a story. But a critic is basically an artist of context. You create this whole other story or more complete story by including the back of the images in the second half of the book.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, where is the art? Well, the art is in the theoretical understanding, the contextual understanding of the image and its placement. And the reason I'm bringing this up now, I'm looking at some of your curatorial work and a show that I'm really sorry I missed. I knew about it, I wanted to get there, was the actual size image. And again, you know, you're radically changing me, you know, as the viewer. But describe to me the history of that show and, you know, where the idea came from, its installation and its response.
Well, I think photographs have a very unresolved relation to scale. You know, a photograph can be, once you've got image capture, whether it's a digital file or a negative, there is then output, right? And an image can be printed very big, very small, on the page of a book, as mm-hmm. an exhibition, on a T-shirt. And wherever you see the photograph, the photographic image, it seems to belong. You know, photographs have a very easy way of belonging wherever you put them in culture. That's not the case with painting. If you see a painting reproduced in a book, you know the painting is somewhere else. It's a thing.
Right.
Photographs, yes, they can be objects, but they are also just image potential, right? And they have a very complicated relation to scale and materiality. You know, if you're a painter, you don't paint your painting and then decide how big it will be. You don't paint your painting and then decide what material it will be made from. But that is the case with photography. And so mm-hmm. when you look at photographs, if you're going through a magazine, you might see a landscape that's 5 miles wide on one page. And then you might see a close-up of a finger on the next page. And we don't think twice about that change in scale at all. The images might be the same dimensions, but the scale in relation to what the subject matter is has changed dramatically. We're very used to that. And that's even the case in most exhibitions. But I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do a show? I needed one very big room, but no more than that. And there is a very big one at the International Center of Photography in New York where I curate. Wouldn't it be interesting to do a show where every image was the same size as what it was of, same size as its subject matter?
Mm-hmm.
It might be a Greyhound bus. In fact, there was an image of a Greyhound bus in that show made by Mason Williams. It's like 38 foot wide. But next to it, there is a postcard that I found on eBay of hailstones that I think fell on Arkansas in 1931. And they're giant. They're the size of golf balls. And they're reproduced on the postcard actual size. Mm-hmm. So if you put that postcard on the wall next to the Greyhound bus, one is tiny, one is giant, but they're actually both actual size. So those hailstones mm-hmm. could have fallen on that bus, so to speak. And I just thought, what if the whole room, whatever is in it, has things that are the same size as their subject matter? That means their relation to the viewer will be one-to-one. It means the relation of those images to the space of the gallery will be one-to-one. Everything will be of the same order of scale. Nothing enlarged, nothing reduced. And I just thought, I've never seen a show like that. And over the years, a number of actual size works had stuck in my head. One of the largest being the Greyhound bus. But another was a spread in a magazine I'd seen as a kid when I was 8 or 9 of the wrapped fists of Muhammad Ali and George Foreman reproduced actual size on the page. And I remember... Oh my. As a 9-year-old, putting my timid little mitt against Ali's fist. And it was just the most kind of visceral, forceful effect that an image could have. You know, wow, that image is a substitute, a one-to-one substitute for Ali's fist, and I can measure mine against it. It was extraordinary. Anyway, I tracked down that magazine, and that was in the show. And, all kinds of things. And it's interesting. I remember when I proposed it to everyone at ICP. It wasn't the only show we were presenting at that time, so not everything had to ride on that show. But I remember proposing it and everyone looking at me and thinking, what? Muhammad Ali's fist, a Greyhound bus, hailstones, whatever else. There's about 15 mm-hmm. things in the show. And it's the only time as a curator I said, look, you'll just have to trust me. Something interesting will happen for the viewer when they are in the space, because they mm-hmm. won't have seen a show like that.
When you are curating, who is, I mean, I realize the answer is both here, but who is more present in your mind, the viewer or the artist?
Oh, the viewer. Okay. And in that show, you know, that had work by, you know, very famous artists, you know, like Jeff Wall and Walker Evans and Mason Williams. But it also had completely anonymous things. It didn't, you know, it didn't really matter who made them. And I like the fact that in photography, you know, interesting things are made and exist in very authored channels like art, but they also exist in channels that can be just as interesting where people don't really know the names of who made them, like an advertising image in a magazine or something like that. So I'm respectful. If the artist is alive, I'll show the work in accordance with how they would like it shown. I don't quote unquote use artworks to kind of make points or anything like that. I'm very respectful in how things should be presented. So I know that there is an author behind the work. But in the end, I think I just want people to encounter the works and the images and the, in this case, the images that are also objects of a particular mm-hmm. dimension. And maybe not get bogged down in, you know, who made it or what their intentions were or all of that. Just set them free amid those works that I've put together.
Oh, I love that idea. You said at the beginning, you know, that you grew up at a time when the culture was all watching these wonderful, intelligent movies.
Yeah.
We are now in a time where every single one of us has a camera in our pocket, and we're being flooded every day. We see, you know, photographic trends, you know, like vernacular photography, going by. Is there an issue? I'm not going to say problem, but is there something to be talked about more about an increasingly visual culture and an increasingly less historically aware about visual culture? how's that for an academic question?
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yes. Although the interesting thing is that problem, if it is a problem, has a history. Right. It's mm-hmm. I know I know we think the problem is ours and is particularly acute now, but you can find artists and cultural commentators and critics in the 20s, you know, pretty much a century ago, the beginning of the 20s, anxious about the sudden, you use the word flooding, and of course flooding is one of the very common metaphors, you know, it's right. Flooding, inundation, bombardment. The image world is supposedly about to overwhelm us, or has overwhelmed us, or it's destroyed our capacity to think, or it's destroyed our memory, or it's distorted our value system. This may well be true, but the interesting thing is it has a long history. And in fact, alongside the actual Size show, I did a show called A Trillion Sunsets, A Century of Image Overload. And it went back to the 20s and said, look, this question about the flood of images is not new. It appears in the early 20s. Why does it appear then? Because there is a sudden expansion of the illustrated press, magazines, newspapers. Cinema is becoming a very dominant mass medium. And you get artists and cultural critics that are saying, whoa, wait a minute, you know, the human mind cannot take all of these images. It's distorting things. It's replacing our value system with a kind of visual value system, all of which is true. But I think it benefits us to understand that this is a problem with the history. It wasn't caused by the internet. It wasn't caused by your smartphone, right?
Right.
There were too many images. When people say there are too many images in the world, only slightly facetiously, I want to ask them, how many would you like? at what point did we reach, you know, kind of optimal level? Is it, mm-hmm. is the number the issue? Or is it the fact that every photograph is excessive? It's not necessarily the numbers of images. Every photograph is excessive because when you open the shutter, the world as light floods in. There are things in the image that you didn't put there. Mm-hmm. This is why photographs are wayward children, going back to the early analogy. I understand that people have an anxiety about the number. And I always want to say, hang on, no, the excess is in every image.
You know what I'm wondering? I have no problem with the number of images. This is the same argument that was made when the printing press was invented. You know, suddenly we're going to have too many books. Literature will cease to exist. I'm wondering, I mean, colleges have photography programs, they have art programs, graduate schools. I'm wondering about putting a middle school, a sixth grade photography course in every, because every sixth grader out there has got a cell phone now. And so you say, guys, we're just going to give you a basic vocabulary. Go do whatever you want. But a basic vocabulary about the history of the image and see what that might do.
I think it's a good point, but just to follow that up, I mean, I don't like the phrase visual literacy because it's...
right, okay.
But let's call it visual literacy, or introducing young children to being able to think critically about the effects that images are having on them in their everyday mm-hmm. life. There was an enormous push to get that to be part of the curriculum in the 70s, early 70s, in North America.
Really?
In North America, in Europe, Central America, very strongly. And the problem was that sooner or later, in fact, sooner, it becomes political, right?
Yeah.
Because you are instructing young minds to be resistant to the propaganda of capitalism, put simply enough.
Yeah.
Whether it's fashion imagery and its presumptions about, you know, gender and race and class, or advertising, or the news values that we see around us, it becomes political, and it should become political very, very quickly. And that got shut down. This was suddenly seen to be the agenda of, you know, hell-bent lefties taking over our education. It's the same old story. And we have left several generations of children that have grown up into adults who are lacking that kind of critical understanding of just the basic ways that images operate upon all of us. It's sad. Sorry that I'm soapboxing there, but
no, I'm with you 100%, man. That you are absolutely right, David. Your work encompasses travel. It encompasses fine art. It encompasses still life. I don't see an element in the photographic world that you haven't touched on yet. And I, for one, am grateful for the ideas that you've put in my head and the way you have articulated a apparently simple but completely unsimple art form. So thank you very much. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Scott. Great pleasure.
Frames. Because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.